Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I want to get into the press and the way that the press has been treating the pullout from Afghanistan. My buddy Dean Obadalla, who is on Sirius XM on the Progress Channel here where I am, 3 hours after I get off the air, I believe his show starts at 6 p.m. Eastern time. We also have a geeky science. Does overpopulation create more violence? Or is there something that can actually kind of act as a flywheel on that? This morning, when Louise and I got up at 5:30, I turned on the TV, and twice while I was listening to TV, I heard people say, commentators on TV say, do we have to worry that Afghanistan is going to become another hotbed of terrorism that will be used to attack America? And I'm like, that's the wrong question. Afghanistan had little or nothing to do with 9/11. 9/11 was Bin Laden apparently wrote the check. Where'd he get the money? He got the money from Ronald Reagan in Saudi Arabia. Not a penny of this came from anybody in Afghanistan. No Afghan national, no Afghan government. They had nothing to do with the planning of 9/11. They had nothing to do with the payment for 9/11. They didn't know 9/11 happened. 9/11 was executed by 15 Saudis, a guy from Egypt, a guy from Lebanon, and there were two other people. What? I think they were Yemenis. I'm not sure. Oh, they were citizens of the United Arab Emirates. That's right. Two from the UAE. Not a single Afghan was involved in 9/11. Oh, but wasn't Bin Laden running a terrorist training camp in Afghanistan? Yes, just like the Michigan militia runs them, you know, in northern Michigan, where a bunch of yahoos get together, pay their $50 fee, and go out in the woods and shoot up trees. That had nothing to do with 9/11. But wasn't the planning for 9/11 done in Afghanistan? No, it was done in Hamburg, Germany. And then a courier, I guess, is the word, from Germany traveled down to Afghanistan just before 9/11 to tell Bin Laden, hey, it's going to happen. Bin Laden at that point knew none of the operational details. That was all handled by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed out of Pakistan and Hamburg, Germany. And then they sent these Saudi hijackers to the United States. Legally, by the way, they all came in on tourist visas. Actually, I think a couple of them came in on educational visas. We want to learn how to be pilots. And Mohammed Atta was down in Venice, Florida, along with a couple of the other guys, learning how to be a pilot. So it was planned in Germany. It was the final planning was done in Florida. Bin Laden at the time was in Pakistan getting blood transfusions because his kidneys were failing. And we decided to attack Afghanistan? Really? Because we said, 9/11 came from Afghanistan. But doesn't the Taliban hate America? The Taliban doesn't give a rat's ass about America if we would just stay the hell out of their country. Afghanistan fought off the Turks. They fought off the Mongol hordes. They fought off the Catholics. They fought off the Persians. They fought off the British. They fought off the Soviets. Well, I thought the Taliban wanted to create a worldwide. No, no, you're thinking of ISIS. ISIS wants to have, they want to reestablish the caliphate across southern Europe, the Middle East, and northern Africa. That's ISIS. That's who, by the way, blew up the bill, you know, blew up the bombs and it killed the people in Afghanistan. It wasn't the Taliban. The Taliban was trying to provide security. They want to run a country. Now, I'm not a big fan of the Taliban. They're throwbacks to the 12th century. But they're not the ones who attacked us on 9/11. George Bush and Dick Cheney would like you to think that. Because, hey, you know, if we're going to have a war to try to get reelected in 2004, why not have a war against a country where the average income is $2 a day, where there's no Air Force to speak of, and where their army is a joke? Let's take on that country. Sort of like just, you know, a little earlier when the humiliating explosion happened in Lebanon that killed over 100 U.S. Marines, as I recall, during the Reagan administration. What was Reagan's response? Let's invade Grenada. Remember? Bin Laden was very clear about why he attacked the United States. It had nothing to do with Afghanistan. He attacked the United States. He told us in 1996 that he was going to do this. Because back in the early 90s, when George Herbert Walker Bush was president of the United States, and he thought having a little war, just like Ronald Reagan had his little war in Grenada, and it helped him get reelected in 1984, maybe if we have a little war in, say, Iraq, just a three-day war, just a little war, it'll help us get reelected in 1992. And so Bush did it. But in order to get the weapons and the airplanes into Iraq, they needed a staging base for that war. So he talked Saudi Arabia into, for the first time, letting Americans take over the Bin Sultan Air Force Base, a Saudi Air Force Base. And we never left. Or at least we didn't. I'll tell you when we left in just a second. But so we took over this Air Force base in Saudi Arabia. And Osama bin Laden, and by the way, a significant chunk of the Saudi population, bin Laden was not alone in this. Bin Laden was expressing an opinion that was held by fundamentalists across the region, particularly in Saudi Arabia, was saying, wait a minute. The war is over. It lasted 3 days. Get your people the hell out of here. You've got men who are watching porn and drinking alcohol on sacred Saudi soil. And you've got women who are showing their elbows and driving cars and probably having sex with the men without being married. They're certainly not covering their faces on sacred Saudi soil. Get the hell out of our country. In 1996, Bin Laden said, this is September 2nd, 1996, we are going to launch a guerrilla war against American forces and expel the infidels from the Arabian Peninsula, end quote. 2 years later, in 1998, Bin Laden met privately with a reporter for The Guardian, quote, we believe we are the men, Muslim men, committed to defending the grandest house in the universe. The holy Saudi Kaaba land is an honor to die and defend. So this is our aim, to liberate the lands of Islam, of Saudi Arabia, from the sinners. End quote. The next year, in a letter to America that was published in the New York Times, Osama bin Laden wrote, quote, your forces occupy our country. You spread your military bases throughout it. You corrupted our lands. You besiege our sanctities. You protect the security of the Jews and to ensure the continuity of your pillage of our treasures, end quote. 9/11 was all about bin Laden saying, get the hell out of Saudi Arabia. And by the way, right after 9/11, guess what President George W. Bush did? He pulled all the American forces out of Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden got exactly what he asked for. And it's not like this was a surprise. Richard Clark, the security advisor for President Clinton, came on this program back in 2002. Or maybe it was 2003. Whatever it was, it must have been 2003, because that's when we started our show, in March of 2003. Came on this program and said, I personally told Condoleezza Rice that bin Laden was going to strike the United States if we didn't get out of it, you know, out of that Air Force base in Saudi Arabia. And I know that Al Gore told that to Dick Cheney, and I know that Bill Clinton told that to George W. Bush, and they basically laughed at us. So why does the media keep saying, oh, gee, if we leave Afghanistan, there's going to be terrorism attacking the United States, when it was never that in the first place? Well, because it's a convenient story that gives Bush and Cheney cover. They wanted a war for re-election purposes, and they got their war. It's that simple. And the war, by the way, was over in fewer than 3 weeks. That's how long it took to take down the Taliban government. And then we started a 20-year occupation, and don't get me started all about that. But this all goes back to Pappy Bush's war that he lied us into, by the way. There were no babies being thrown out of incubators. That was a stunt put together by an American PR firm with a princess from a former Kuwaiti princess testified, lying to the United States Congress, saying they're throwing babies out of incubators, those nasty Iraqi soldiers. George Herbert Walker Bush wanted to lie us into a little war so he could get himself reelected. In doing so, he put soldiers in Saudi Arabia, pissed off Osama bin Laden, and he struck us on 9/11. Let's tell the friggin' truth about what happened. I mean, if the media is going to ask questions, they need to ask the right questions. Here are my three nominees. You can add whatever you want. Number one, how did Bush and Cheney get away with lying us into a war and a 20-year occupation of Afghanistan and nearly that long in Iraq without political or historic consequences? Number two, why did the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations, three administrations, two Republican, one Democratic, why did they, all knowing that these occupations were a lost cause and a waste of American blood and treasure, why didn't they get us out before now? And number three, what can we do in the Middle East and elsewhere around the world, if that is our goal, to promote peace, modernity, and democratic values without using warplanes, drones, soldiers, and bombs? When we start asking those questions, when we start having that conversation, then America will have grown up. But right now, we're still stuck in this infantile stage where we are giving an absolute pass to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney for lying to us, for their war crimes, for their torture, for everything else. And somehow the Republicans are turning the outcome of these lies into a political problem for Joe Biden, for God's sake, who's just trying to clean up the mess that was left in by three previous presidents that was started by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Let's tell the truth about this. Damn it, let's do it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you want all the details and the hot links and everything, it's all over at HartmanReport.com. Jeremy in Indianapolis. Hey, Jeremy, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I believe that scientists could certainly learn a lot more about human mentality by studying how we behave in video games. And there's some behaviors anecdotally that I was wondering, you know, I'd like your thoughts on them, kind of, as well as anybody else who's out there's thoughts on them. One thing I've noticed is that, you know, video games back in the day used to be slower, more intellectual, partly because computers weren't as fast as they are now, but also because nerds were the ones, you know, making them for nerds.
I know. I wrote game for the kids in our community for abused kids back in 1980. It ran on a TRS-80 Model 3. It was written in BASIC. Four pages of BASIC code. That's how I learned BASIC. But anyhow, it was very simple. It was like a treasure hunt, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it was full of if-thens, you know?
Yeah, I actually started with QBasic, but I did stuff in Basic as well.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I've noticed is, like, the most popular PC games out there tend to be ones that are reflex-based, but also, not just that, but they tend to be ones where people can jump into a team semi-anonymously, and you play these like, MOBA games, they're called. I don't know if you've heard of them, or you know, in some of the first-person
shooter ones. I'm really out of touch with this, yeah. So
it's fine, but basically you join a team of random people. And then what happens is, if you win, well, you're the most awesome player there was. You know, you totally carry the team. You're the best guy ever. But if you lose, well, it's not my fault. My team was terrible. You know, I didn't do anything wrong. And I think that exposes something with human mentality. You know, if in general, like with things with like global warming and COVID right now and everything else in the world, that you know that it's like. You know, I jump in, we win, I'm awesome, but, you know, we lose, well, it's not my fault.
It's also not a reflection of reality, Jeremy. I mean, if, you know, anybody who's ever participated in a team sport, you know, or in the military, gets mm-hmm. it that, you know, the team, your life depends on the team, and the team's
right.
life depends on you. And you guys are
right.
as interconnected and interrelated, you know, assuming that you're facing some sort of really serious mission, as our family.
Yeah, but you're not anonymous when you're
exactly.
like on a soccer field.
Oh, it's the exact opposite of being
American
anonymous.
Football field.
It's like
right.
you're integrated
right.
into, you're knit into that group. That's the whole point
right.
of the team.
But when we're a country or the world, then we're facing things like global warming or a pandemic. You know, are you really part of the team, or are you just an
anonymous
member?
So your argument
member?
Is that modern video games are increasing individual isolation and increasing the mentality that society, you know, Margaret Thatcher's old thing, there's no such thing as society, there's only a collection of individuals, that we don't have responsibility for each other.
Well, it's certainly exposing it, if not increasing it. And I do wonder what if it is increasing it or not.
It's a fascinating
thesis. Yeah. And there's one more, if I got a moment, which is you were speaking before about savior mentality, you know, savior is going to come and save us mentality. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that the consequences of the video games have also gone down, and people are, you know, they're playing video games, they don't face real consequences. And then when they're in reality, of course, has real consequences, but are
right.
we really prepared for that as well as we used to be
right.
as a people?
Interesting.
So, yep. Thank
yeah.
you.
Jeremy, thought-provoking stuff. Thank you. Remarkable. The things people are thinking about that are really consequential. We'll be right back.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
On the line with us, our old buddy, Dean Obadalla, host of the Dean Obadalla Show, weekdays 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Sirius XM Progress Radio 127. He's a columnist for the Daily Beast. DeanOfRadio.com is his website. You can tweet him at Dean Obadalla. Kind of intuitive. And, of course, on SXM Progress. Dean, welcome back to the program. Your op-ed on MSNBC inspired my rant. And I, by the way, I gave you credit. I don't know if you've read it yet.
I saw it. Yes. No, I read your newsletter. I subscribe. It's a great newsletter. I saw that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For giving me a shout out.
Thank you very much, because I, you know, I've been rolling this idea around in my head for a long time that that there are just huge parallels between the authoritarian Taliban movement and the authoritarian Republican movement and all the things that go along with authoritarianism. I think, you know, you could draw parallels back to some of the right-wing parties in Europe in the 1930s as well. But you just laid it out brilliantly. Share with our listeners your riff here.
Sure. I mean, essentially, there's two levels to it. The first was, hey, there's these Republicans like Kevin McCarthy and others saying, we have to stand up for the women of Afghanistan, which I applaud that. But my thesis was, well, why not stand up for women's rights in America first, because it'll give you more credibility. So I'm not at all saying don't stand up for the women in Afghanistan. Yes, they're facing a really dark future under Taliban rule. If the last time the Taliban ruled from the mid-1990s, 2001, is a preview of what we might see now. So that was first. But second, the other part was, and I'm very blunt because I didn't want to play games. I don't say the GOP and the Taliban are the same. But I do say this, and this is the truth, that a similar playbook from the extremists within the GOP, that they want to turn their religious beliefs into the law of the land, and specifically in terms of oppressing women. And they have Arkansas, I give an example specifically, Arkansas, they passed a law in March banning abortion except for the life of the woman who's pregnant, meaning if you are raped in Arkansas, you can't get an abortion. And if anyone helps you try to get an abortion, it's a felony. That's literally the law. That's not a proposal. That's the law. It's held up by the federal courts right now. But I started my article with that, sort of the idea of if you write about a place where women can't get abortion even if they're raped and it's a crime to help them get an abortion, would that be a Taliban law? I said, no, it's an Arkansas GOP law. And that's really what they want the law of the land to be. And I cite Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, when signing it, specifically citing his pro-life beliefs, which I respect people's religious beliefs. I just don't want them the law of the land. I'm a person of faith, too. I'm not going to make my Muslim beliefs the law of America. That's outrageous. I'll fight anyone, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, any faith, who wants to turn their law into their rules into our law. That's Islamic Sharia. These guys want to do Christian Sharia. And it's time we call it out even more. And it, Tom, it really pissed them off in ways. There were op-eds written against me in Fox News, Town Hall, The Washington Examiner today, their editorial board, not the op-ed, their editorial board attacked me for writing this, the Catholic League and others. But what I find curious, Tom, not one of them in any article says they don't want to turn their religious beliefs into the law of the land. They're upset with me hinting the Taliban and the GOP is the same. They want to turn their religion, their perverted view of the Bible into our law. They're not denying that. That's where they are. That's what they're about.
This is not a new debate in the United States, Dean. Back at the founding of the Republic, there's a whole series of letters back and forth between when Thomas Jefferson was in Paris as the U.S. envoy to Paris, and his protege James Madison, who almost a decade later would be known as the father of the Constitution. They were corresponding about what ultimately became the First Amendment and the no religious test clause in the Constitution. And Jefferson's fear was that priests could become politicians, and that religious, and he was in favor of religious figures being barred as long as they held a religious office, being barred from public office. And right. Madison, who was, and of course Jefferson was basically an atheist, he was a deist. Madison, on the other hand, was either a Presbyterian or a Congregationalist. He was, you know, kind of one of these kind of plain vanilla Christian guys, but he was very into his Christian faith. And Madison was not concerned about that. He figured that we would be able to control priests in political office. He was concerned about the corruption of the church by government. In other words, Jefferson was afraid that government would be corrupted by the church. Madison was afraid that the church would be corrupted by government, so much so that when he became president in 1809, the first veto that James Madison issued The George Washington administration had started a poorhouse in Washington, D.C. for the poor. It was paid for with federal funds. And it housed them, it clothed them, it fed them, and it gave them medical care. And and during the Madison administration, so we, you know, welfare in the United States, socialism goes back to George Washington. But in the Madison administration, here we now, he's the fourth president, the Congress had passed a law that took control of that poorhouse out of the hands of the federal government and put it in the hands of the local of a local church, and with the federal government paying the church to do it. In other words, you know, kind of subcontracting it. That was Madison's first veto. And he vetoed it, saying that it would establish a precedent of the federal government giving money to religious organizations, which could destroy religion, which would corrupt religion. And I think you could argue we have both. You know, you've got all these religious organizations that are taking piles of money from you know, political sources and whatnot. And at the same time, you've got all these religious folks inside government. Which do you think, you know, so I think both of their nightmares came true. And both of them were trying to reassure the other, oh, your idea is never going to happen. They were both right. They were both wrong. But how is it worse, Dean? You know, I know that you're far more finely, you know, acutely aware of this than I am, given the fact that you're Muslim and, you know, after 9/11, this just, you know, you and so many other people, you know, of your faith had a bullseye on your back, essentially, at least a political one. You know, your thoughts on that debate and how it's playing out today.
Well, yeah, I always think of Thomas Jefferson's famous letter to the ministers talking about the absolute wall between church and state that he envisioned. And to me, that really was giving you a sense of what he believed the First Amendment was going to be and what it should be. You know, you have the GOP increasingly looking like the autocratic party. We know that the religious infused autocratic party. And, you know, I was doing research earlier. It's not in this article. I'll probably write an article later. But you have more rights as a woman in many, many Muslim countries over the control of your own body than you would in Arkansas if this law remained in effect. And when you see Asa Hutchinson, when you see the GOP state senator in Arkansas, when they signed this, he talked about our goal is to abolish abortion throughout the nation. They even want to get rid of it, Tom. In the case of the woman carrying the fetus, if her life is at risk, they don't want to let her get an abortion. And their idea is that it's God's will. Right. Look, I'm all down with God's will, but you don't make that law of the land. You know, that's ridiculous. In Muslim country after Muslim country, the life of the mother, they can always get an abortion. And in countries like Tunisia, you can get it for almost any reason you want. It's not really a very conservative country, but still you have the spectrum within that world where people think, oh, wow, Muslims horribly oppressive. Yes, in certain countries they are. In others, they've evolved. And you know, you can't get away from the fact that GOP and the Taliban are similar in this. They truly want to make their religious text and their interpretation of that, because I can assure you, as a Muslim, there's almost no one in the Muslim world that now adheres to the Taliban's view, but they want to make it the law of the land. And look at Tom, for an example. People, I hate when the media goes, Taliban wants to impose Sharia. They don't even know what Sharia means when they say it. Right. It's not a book of law. Look at Pakistan, neighbors Afghanistan. Pakistan elected a woman as prime minister, Benazir Bhutto, twice. We haven't elected a woman. 60% of the doctors in Pakistan are women. CEOs of companies are women. So who defined Islam correctly? Is it Pakistan or is it Afghanistan, Taliban, which is way out there as an outlier? I think, though, in America, the GOP represents their view of Christianity. It's an extremist view. I don't think it's mainstream, but I still think it's oppressive. And I had so many emails from these people going, well, this is, they cite the Bible to me, going, well, that should be the law. I go, in the Bible, it says in the Old Testament, if a woman's not a virgin on her wedding night, she should be stoned to death. Is that next? It says in the New Testament, a woman should learn in silence. Will we be next making that law? And they disappear when you ask that, because I've had this debate over years when they've said Muslims want to impose the Quran in America. We don't. There's no evidence of this. But look at the Bible. You want to find some scary things and some great things? Yeah. If you're a right-wing Christian, why not start with imposing in Matthew, which says, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger. You welcomed me in. Let's start there with that Christianity. And then we can talk about other things and debate that later.
Dean, we just have a minute and a half, by the way, until we're going to hit a hard break here. How do we start deconstructing this binding of fundamental radical Christianity to the Republican Party?
I don't think it's possible. I think that's they've made that. We may have even talked about it on the show. At one point, the pro-life movement wasn't a part and parcel of the GOP in turning that religious belief into the law of the land. But the GOP continues down that path. And like with most things, the GOP becomes more extreme. At one point, Tom, we all know this, they were okay with three exceptions for abortion: rape, incest, the life of the mother. Now they're down to one, the life of the woman who's pregnant, and now they're moving to even ban that because of God's will. I'm not kidding. So the GOP is becoming more and more extreme. It won't end with abortion. It can't. And it's going to be a dark day for the women of America where they have less rights simply because of their gender. Like in Afghanistan, it's a crime to be born a woman. I hate to think in America that's where we're heading. If Roe versus Wade happens, you're a woman in a red state, it will be a crime to be a woman because you will literally have less rights in your red state than you will in a blue state. That's why abortion can't be states' rights.
Yeah, not so much literally a crime as you're simply less than fully human.
That's what I mean by that.
You're
already suffering. And as I know in my article, these Republicans talk about women's rights. Tom, you know, we had Kevin McCarthy and others voted against the Violence Against Women Act, voting against equal pay 2 months ago. All of them. Start there, Republicans. Show us you care about women, gender equality, and protecting women and their control of their body by fighting for America's women. How about that first?
Yeah, there you go. And in my opinion, that's just the tip of the iceberg, too. So Dean Obadalla, the great Dean Obadalla, deanofradio.com. You can listen to him on. Hang on just a second here. I'm going to get stepped on. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can listen to him on Sirius XM every day, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Channel 127, Sirius XM Progress. Thank you, Dean.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be right back. Hi, it's Tom Hartman Book Club, and today we're reading from What Would Jefferson Do? And this is from the chapter Warlords, Theocrats, and Autocrats, Aristocrats Rise Again, the subchapter Theocrats Attack Democracy. And the epigraph that we started the chapter with is from President Abraham Lincoln, where he said, "I am approached with the most opposite opinions and advice and by men who are equally certain that they represent the divine will. I hope it will not be irreverent of me to say that if it is probable that God would reveal his will on such a point so connected with my duty, it might be supposed he would reveal it directly to me." So the subhead of the chapter, America is a Christian nation. No, it's a nation where a lot of Christians live. And I read about Judge Moore and his Ten Commandments thing and his statement that, you know, America was founded in Christianity, and then proceed to share the founder's actual view on this. "Our founders were both well-schooled in the history of the Crusades and knew from firsthand experience with Puritanism how oppressive religious men could be, even with small amounts of political power. Ben Franklin fled Boston when he was a teenager, in part to escape the oppressive environment created by politically powerful preachers. And for the rest of his life, he was openly hostile to the idea of a secular power being wielded by those who hold also religious power. Although he was fascinated by the spiritual experience, Franklin had little use for the organized religions of his day. In his autobiographical Toward the Mystery, he wrote, quote, I have found Christian dogma unintelligible. Early in life, I absented myself from Christian assemblies, end quote. In his autobiography, Franklin talks about how he came to this way of thinking, quote, my parents had early given me religious impressions and brought me through my childhood piously dissenting in the Puritan way. But I was scarce 15 when, after doubting by turns of several points, as I found them disputed in the different books I read, I began to doubt of revelation itself. Some books against deism fell into my hands. They were said to be the substance of sermons preached at Boyle's lectures. It happened that they wrought an effect on me quite contrary to what was intended by them, for the arguments of the deists, which were quoted to be refuted, appeared to me much stronger than the refutations, and I soon became a thorough deist." End of quote. Franklin, like most of the more well-known founders, was a deist, subscribing to a philosophy made popular by Unitarians who held that the Creator made the universe long ago and has since chosen not to interfere in any way, that neither Jesus nor anybody else was divine, or alternatively, that we are all divine, and that there is only one God and not three. Another founding deist who resisted giving political power to those with religious power was George Washington. Jefferson's diary entry for February 1, 1799 reads, quote, "When the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never, on any occasion, said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion. And they thought that they should so pen their address as to force him, at length, to declare fidelity, whether he was a Christian or not. They did so. However, Jefferson noted, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address, particularly except that which he passed over without even notice." Jefferson concluded that Washington, quote, "never did say a word on the subject in any of his public papers, and that Governor Morris, a close friend of Washington's, has often told me that General Washington believed no more in that Christian system than he himself did, than Governor Morris did." End of quote from Jefferson. In fact, President George Washington supervised the language of a treaty with African Muslims that explicitly stated that the United States was a secular nation. The treaty with Tripoli, worked out under Washington's guidance and then signed into law the next year by John Adams in 1797, reads, quote, "As the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims, and as the said states never have entered into any war or act of hostility against any Muslim nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries," end of quote. But for the founders, this wasn't just an issue of being Christian or not. They didn't want any organized religion mixing its functions with government. For example, on February 21st, 1811, President James Madison vetoed a bill passed by Congress that authorized government payments to a church in Washington, D.C. to help the poor. Faith-based initiatives were a clear violation, in Madison's mind, of the First Amendment doctrine of separation of church and state, and could lead to a dangerous transfer of political power to religious leaders. Caring for the poor was a public and civic duty, a function of government, and should not be allowed to become a hole through which churches could reach and seize political power or the taxpayer's purse. Funding a church to provide for the poor would establish, in Madison's words, a legal agency, a legal precedent. It would break down the walls of separation the founders had put between church and states to protect Americans from religious zealots gaining political power. Thus, Madison said in his veto message to Congress, he was striking down the proposed law because it helped a church to, quote, "provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same," which, Madison warned, would be a precedent for giving to religious societies. That would be giving federal funds. Now, things have certainly changed since then with the faith-based initiative program that started under Reagan has now exploded. But anyhow, the book is What Would Jefferson Do?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Michael in Seattle. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the show. I'm a big fan, and I also really like your books.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you and really, you know, Democrats in general to take in a much more aggressive stance in defending Joe Biden. And I think it's a really fabulous and brilliant decision to exit Afghanistan. There's just no point in staying there anymore. And yeah. I just barely hear any half-hearted defense at all. I haven't heard words like applaud, you know, this great decision. So what are your thoughts on that?
I, you know, one of the things I wanted to do today, and I touched on it briefly in the first hour, and I will embrace it more fulsomely, more wholeheartedly after this break, Michael, was to congratulate Joe Biden on the fact that he's gotten 30,000 people out of Afghanistan against, you know, a complete sabotage, a 2.5-year-long sabotage effort by the Trump administration. He's pulling it off, and not a single person has been killed in the process. I realize there were a couple of deaths outside the airport, basically people being trampled by the crowd. But that's not Joe Biden's fault. It has nothing to do with it. What happened was that, for the first week or so, that this seems to be being botched up. And what we now have learned is what we were watching was the result of Donald Trump and Steve Miller stopping the special immigrant visa program, the SIV program, because it would have brought brown people into the United States. They stopped this back in 2018. and and threw a monkey wrench into the works. And Biden has put it back together. He started this program back up in February of this year. And, early last week, at least through Thursday, I was saying, I was criticizing Biden for not having gotten ahead of the curve and not having gotten more done more quickly. Now I am figuring it out. And, sadly, it took a long time for the mainstream media to help inform me of this, because there really wasn't that much good information about what had happened and how it came about, that, to whatever extent there are failures in our getting out of Afghanistan, you can lay those right at the feet of Donald Trump. And let's also point out that Joe Biden had the courage to do this when President Obama knew for 8 years that this war was unwinnable, or this occupation was unwinnable, that it was going to end in disaster, that somebody had to pull out eventually, and he didn't have the political courage to do it. And I think you could say the same is true for the last 4 years of the Bush administration, at which point it was obvious that the occupation was not going well, and for the entire 4 years of the Trump administration. So here we have, at least 18 of the last 20 years of complete political cowardice or marginal political cowardice. And now President Biden stands up and says, I'm going to do what's right. And I don't care if it's going to hurt my popularity ratings. I'm going to do what's right. He deserves a lot of credit for that.
And Democrats all over and almost no Democrats have come to his defense for making that incredibly difficult and brave decision. Thank you.
Well, I think Democrats are starting to, Michael, and I'll put myself in that list. So thank you.
Let this be about the getting everybody out. We have to let this discussion be about this incredibly brilliant decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, thank you. There's a fascinating little geeky science here that I wanted to share with you, and I think this is really, really interesting. The title of the article, this came out of Okayama University in Japan, and the title of the article is Scientists Dig Deep to Understand the Effects of Population Pressure on Violence Levels. And there's an intuitive part and a counterintuitive part to it. It's absolutely fascinating comparing the two. What they found is that, yes, in fact, there is an association between high population pressures and violence. Now, you can imagine that would be the case, right? That the more people are competing for resources, the more violence you're going to have, and the more other social ills associating with that. And they specifically tie this to resource scarcity leading to competition and conflict over resources. This is called the population pressure hypothesis. But then they did this historical study. They went back to the middle Yayoi period. This is 350 BC to 25 CE or AD, a period of almost 400 years. And looking at the skeletal remains in these jar coffers, these are very, very well-preserved skeletal remains, to find out what was going on. And what they found was that during those periods of time when there was a highly functioning government in this region, violence went down, even though population pressure was very high. And during those times when the government became weaker, which is exactly what, the Taliban and the Republicans and the libertarian billionaires all want, right, is a weaker federal government. Well, actually, I suppose you could argue that the Republicans and the Taliban want a strong federal government when it comes to oppressing women and gays and folks like that. But generally speaking, when it comes to protecting the people, they want a weaker government. And during those times when there was a weaker government, there was more interpersonal violence, there was more murder, there was more crime. And I just found this absolutely fascinating, wanted to share it with you. Yes, government can be a force for good when it's done right. So, anyhow, pick up your phone calls on the other side of this break. We've got a lot going on here. Is the Taliban Is the Republican Party the American version of the Taliban? Or is that hyperbole? Is that going too far?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
You want to, you know, reel me back in here? Take me, walk me off this ledge? Try it. We'll be back with your calls.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So what do you think? Is the Republican Party, have they become? I mean, they weren't always this way, right? The Eisenhower Republican Party, even arguably the Nixon Republican Party, was not a Taliban-like party. But, you know, ever since Ronald Reagan brought George W. Bush, the son of his vice president, in as the advisor to connect the Republican Party and the Reagan administration to the religious right, and both Reagan and Bush, Vice President Bush at that time, did a complete 180 on abortion. Reagan had signed the most liberal abortion law in the United States as governor of California. George Herbert Walker Bush, I don't recall if he was on the board of Planned Parenthood or if he just regularly did fundraisers for them, but he was a big booster, as was his wife Barbara. They completely changed in 2001 at the suggestion of their son to bring in the right-wing Christian crazies. Has the Republican Party become the Taliban? Britt in Eureka, California. Hey, Britt, thanks for listening to KGOE. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? Thanks Good. For having me on. Yeah, hey, I guess, you know, I'd love to be able to take apart your theory about the American Taliban, but, you know, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to double down on it for you. I think everything you said this morning on your rant was appropriate and made perfect sense. How could I really refute it? I would, however, point out that there are some differences between what I consider, you know, obviously the real Taliban and our American Taliban, the Republican Party. The big difference in my mind is that since essentially about 1980, the so-called Reagan Revolution, they have been well-funded by the American oligarchy, basically. You know, I think about the lobbyists and all of the people who have donated to the Republican Party and provided them the, you know, basically the means to become, to develop into this party that is, you know, misogynistic, mm-hmm. that is anti-democratic, that is anti-science, that is all of these things that you outlined this morning. I think the big difference is that here in America, the American Taliban, also known as the hard right, the hardcore right Republican Party, is well funded and is supported by educated people in government. You know, I hate to say it, I don't know how good of an education is, but when you have guys from Harvard and Yale who are conservative Republicans who should know better, supporting the hard right Trumpist policies that are the forefront of the Republican Party, I think that's one of the core differences between the Taliban in Afghanistan and what we have here in America.
Yeah. Excellent points, Britt. Excellent points. And I can't disagree. I don't have a an argument against it. In fact, we funded the Taliban, the early Taliban, the Mujahideen, yep, and the Taliban to fight the Soviets. And then, you know, they were funded in part also by some of the Middle Eastern countries. And of course, there's some very, very wealthy people in Pakistan who support the Taliban, that being where Osama bin Laden went to live, where he was on 9/11, where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed planned 9/11 in part. I mean, most of the planning actually was done in Germany and in Jupiter, Florida. None of it was done in Afghanistan. Why we invaded Afghanistan? Well, because it was the second poorest country in the world. It was a guaranteed victory for George W. Bush. And he was very clear, you know, in 1999, he told his biographer that he was going to have he was going to be a war president. That was the key to being seen as a great leader. And he got it. Britt, thank you. Thank you very much. Brian in Booth Bay, Maine. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I love the show. I've been a longtime listener. I'm 37 years old, and I started listening about 12 years ago. It's my first time calling.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for all you do. I wanted to talk about religion, religious moderates giving cover to the extremists, mm-hmm, but I'd also like to offer a solution to your question to Dean. How do we fix it? How do we fix the big problem? It's in my opinion, and I'm coming from a privileged position of being an atheist almost my whole life, but more importantly, I'm a skeptic. I look at things skeptically, critically. I weigh the claims against the evidence. And that's what religious moderates, in my opinion, should start doing. And to answer your question to Dean, it's all about education. We need to radically shift towards critical thinking and skepticism in our education program. And that will fundamentally reduce the influence that religion has as a tool to manipulate people into doing horrific acts of violence or even subtle acts of violence. Look at the simple racism and the simple acts that you see every day and hear about every day that leads to mass shootings and drug abuse and violence and pedophilia, child trafficking, you name it. The list is extensive. That's my solution to the problem. But it's really I would like this opportunity to reach out to your listeners and your religious moderates who know that they're good people, that want the church and the synagogue and the temples that they may attend to do the right thing. But you have to look at this critically. We're only going to graduate as a species from these Bronze Age and ancient ideas and theories if we come together as an intelligent species and save ourselves from the destruction that we're bringing down on us.
Yeah. You know, religion, before science, religion served the function of science, which is helping people make sense out of things that don't seem to make sense. You know, why did Ralph get hit by that bolt of lightning? Well, it must have been because Thor was pissed off, right? And now we can say, oh, well, it's because he was standing in a field and there was an electrical charge associated with his head that was closer to the clouds. I would submit to you that Europe, Louise and I lived in Europe for a year back in the 80s. We lived in Germany. And the churches, yes, there's some people who go to church on Sundays and even on Wednesday nights and things who are really committed to their religion. But by and large, the churches in Europe serve ceremonial functions. They are the places where transitions of childhood to adulthood are made, where weddings are performed, where deaths are mourned. They are more ceremonial than they are fervent. And I believe that part of that is because Europe, for hundreds of years, saw something that the United States only saw in a little tiny bit of the country, which was what happens when government gets taken over by religious crazies. The Catholic Church launching the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, the absolute iron fist really of the Catholic Church right up until the 1500s. And then, of course, the Protestant Reformation and all the wars that were fought around the Protestant Reformation, ultimately. And at a certain point, I think the people in Europe said, okay, that's it. You know, we're not going to take this stuff seriously anymore. And by the way, that kind of coincided with the scientific revolution, you know, with Copernicus and everybody else. Here in the United States, that was largely limited to the to a little stretch of land between Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. And, you know, Ben Franklin was born in Massachusetts. He fled Massachusetts when he was 16 or 17 years old because they were they were past the point of burning witches, but they were still torturing women at that point in time. And he was like, OK, that's it. I'm out of here. And that's why he went to Philadelphia, because Philadelphia was a completely secular city. And that value system informed our, you know, the people who wrote the Constitution and you could say the founders and framers of this country. And I think we are only just now, in a big way, on a nationwide level, seeing a return of this kind of religious fervor in a way that is bleeding into governance, like we saw in Massachusetts in the late 16, early 1700s. And I'm very worried that it's going to take, you know, a real shock to the system for Americans to wake up to how toxic this kind of religion is, you know, whether it's another Jim Jones kind of event or whether it's just, you know, the progressive oppression of women and a large blowback against that. What do you think, Brian?
I agree with what you said. I want to know if you think America has the capacity to really grasp the damage that that extreme religion has, and if the religious moderates who are giving cover implicitly, it's not an explicit kind of cover. It's not like I'm religious, so all religion is justified. You know, it's the idea that, well, my religion isn't murdering women or cutting hands off. It's not a problem of religion. I wonder if Americans have the capacity to realize that it is the indoctrination of our children that manipulate our brains.
I think so, because we did it once before. I mean, this, you know, okay. When they got together in Philadelphia in 1787 to write the Constitution, in two different places, they put religion, or at least the freedom from religion, into the Constitution. There shall be no religious test for public office. That's written into the body of the Constitution itself. And then that people shall be free from religion. The practice of religion shall be freely exercised. But similarly, the failure, the lack of practice to religion shall be you know, free of interference by government. That didn't happen in a vacuum. That was in response to what was going on in Massachusetts, Brian, which was being run as a theocracy. Massachusetts almost didn't get allowed to join the 13 colonies because they had to alter their constitution before they could join the 13 colonies, because up until that point, their constitution stipulated that people had to pay taxes to churches and they had to show up every week. And the police, well, one of the jobs of the police was to go house to house and drive people out of their houses if they weren't in church. So I think we've been there before. I think we can do it again.
To Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
At least I hope we can do it again. Because we're awful close. John in Watertown, Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes. Hi, Tom. I just real quickly here wanted to ask you. I know you were talking before about how during your, you know, with Ronald Reagan in 1980, the moral majority and everything, how the religious right kind of took over the Republican Party. But I also remember Jimmy Carter was a strongly religious man, and mm-hmm. he was a Democrat. And I'm just wondering, would somebody like that even be electable today as president?
You know, Jimmy Carter was quite personal about his Christianity. He did not wear it on his sleeve. He didn't talk about it very much. He did not use it as an excuse for any kind of policy. He didn't cite his Christianity to end abortion. He didn't even cite his Christianity for doing things like Habitat for Humanity. He simply said it was the right thing to do. So while he was and still is a dedicated Christian and a Bible school teacher, Did not exploit religion for political purposes the way that Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush did, following the advice of George W. Bush, who created this marriage between the Falwell and Robertson and Tony Perkins wing of hardcore right-wing Taliban-style Christianity in the United States and the Reagan administration, and ultimately the entire Republican Party. So I think not. I don't think the analogy is apt, John.
Because I had a lot of respect for Jimmy Carter. I think he carried himself very well. He was humble, and he was true to his I think he was faithful to his wife. He was he served in the Navy and everything.
Jimmy Carter was a good man. Is a good man.
Yeah.
I am such a Jimmy Carter fan, and the more time goes by, the more I appreciate his presidency, and what he did for America, how he helped this country, and his efforts. I mean, his effort to do something about the energy crisis was nothing short of heroic. It was undone by Ronald Reagan, but it could have saved this country a hell of a lot of suffering and expense right now if we had actually paid attention to him back in the 1970s. John, thank you for the call. I honor Jimmy Carter. We'll be back same bat time, same bat place. In the meantime, I want to thank Louise Hartman, Sean Taylor, Nate Atwell, Jamie Holly, Joyce the Hammer, Nance, Nigel Peacock, Sue Nethercutt, Patrick White, Geraldine Halbert, Ron Hartenbaum, Chase Spross, Nicholas Miller, Pat Sweeney, Jabbermocky, Jay LeBlanc, Connor Arroyo, and Carne Verde. Thank you.
All the folks who helped make this show work for you, and thank you for helping keep us going. Be good to yourself and those around you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.